Thank you, Doug. It's so good to see all of you and that you would all come out on a Sunday night, particularly on such an exciting and absorbing topic as postmodernism. But I'll try to make it as interesting as possible and explain it briefly. All of us were born into a world that we did not create. God did. But we were also born into a culture that we did not create. And God didn't create that. God doesn't create culture, at least not directly. That's what man does. He shapes culture and shapes society. The culture into which we were born was one of almost everybody here, except maybe some of you that are youngest, of what I'd like to call modernism as it's transitioning into postmodernism. Now, you know, the society that we're born into, the culture we're born into, until we grow a little bit and learn, seems very normal or normative for us, right? Because we don't have anything to compare it to. But as we get older, and maybe we start reading or we talk to people from different cultures or we do some investigation, we say, oh, things weren't always like this in the world. Well, when we think about postmodernism and modernism, which I'll discuss briefly, this is the world we were born into. And it's almost impossible for us to conceive of what it would be like to live in a world that is not modern or postmodern. You can a little bit by reading what people in 1648 or 1317 or AD 94 were saying and thinking, but there were things they didn't say that they assumed that we would never assume. So I want to talk for a minute about this kind of culture that we're living in today and define it as essentially postmodern. But to get to that, we need to understand first what modern means. I don't mean by the term modern its generic usage. Oh, that's a modern car, by which we mean one that has a CD player, or even today, no CD player, but just a jack in which you could play MP3. I mean, after all, it's CD players in cars, in many cases, are just kind of old and obsolete. That's not how I'm using the term modern, or modernist, or modernity. By modern, I mean a particular way of thinking, a worldview that became prominent late in the 19th century and has influenced every single one of us in this room. I guess the best way briefly to describe it is to recall an anecdote, a story. Sharon's and my oldest son, he's, 36. About 7 or 8 years ago, he started doing doctoral studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, just not far over the border. So he was taking us for a tour of the campus, and we came to the Department of Modern Art. And there was an advertisement there for a particular display of modern art at the time, and I will never forget it. It was, of course, one of these traveling exhibits. And so here we see this whole building given to modern art, where all the students involved in modern art were studying. And right over the top is the name of this exhibit. And it was this: We Are the Destroyers. There's probably no better summary of what modernism is than that. We are the destroyers. If there were another one I could give you, there was the first modernist, at least the man who invented that term, a French poet called Charles Baudelaire, who would say, the theme of modernism is make it new. Make it new. Make it new. Modernism is largely the idea that to live the good, fulfilled life, you have to break away from the past. And that the standards of the past and the ethics of the past and all of that are old and boring, and therefore every single generation must sort of recreate its own ethical standards, its own standards of architecture, its own standards of art, its own standards of literature, its own standards of theology and the church. Ever hear of modernists, theological modernists? We use the term today liberal, but really they're roughly synonymous. Liberals are modernists. So all of this, a chief element of modernism is the attempt to cut off and do away with tradition. Jeff was making a comment earlier about tradition. You see, before modernism, it wasn't that there weren't new things. Of course there were new things. But almost everybody everywhere said, you know what, there are very important things about the past that we need to preserve. And even when we're developing something new in architecture or art, we want to maintain a continuity with the past. We want organically things. For instance, if we're doing a particular kind of painting, we want it to be a realistic painting. And even, as some of you have seen medieval paintings, a lot of them with the Madonna and so on, even when they were of the spirit world, they were realistic as people would have seen them to be. That is, if you really had seen angels or the devil, this is what they believe they would have looked like. And I'm just taking one example. But once you get to Impressionism, has anybody ever seen any of the paintings of Monet or people like that? Well, and even Impressionism is not too bad. But basically, there's the idea of art. The important thing is not things as they are, but the impression they make on us. And so there's just sort of this quickness. And that's another mark of modernism, that everything is changing all the time and that life is transitory. Everything is changing. Now, because of this, one element of modernism, and I'm getting to postmodernism in a minute, is a planned obsolescence, we would say. Planned obsolescence. Everybody here, though you might not know what that term means, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. For example, here's a big change in my own lifetime. How many of you in the last 5 or 10 years, you had your TV breakdown and you called your local TV repairman? Now, I remember a TV repairman. One of them worked in our church in Florida in the 60s and 70s. My father was a pastor. Made a good living repairing TVs. You remember these big old heavy honking tubes? And he made a good living. You know, charged probably at that time $45, $30 for a service call, and got enough service calls, he could make a good living. Well, if you charge today $125 for a service call, you'd say, well, heck, I can buy a TV, a new TV, a nice big one for maybe a couple hundred bucks or more. Why would I call a serviceman? Why? Because of planned obsolescence. So you know the very pleasant people at Apple right now in Silicon Valley, do you know that, you say, well, there's iPhone. I mean, how many are there going to be? There was the brand new, spanking new iPhone 4, and now they're at 10. I was talking to a friend of mine in IT. I said, are they kind of working on like next year's? He says, you don't understand, Andrew. They're already working on 14 and 15. It's planned obsolescence. Now, that is about physical things. But you see, this is also a mentality. Ideas themselves have a planned obsolescence. Now, the final element of modernism that I'll talk about is the notion that length of the movement of linear history, that is, history moves forward, is also the measure of moral improvement. That is, things go on, we get smarter about how we're supposed to live, and our morality gets better. In 2008, Barack Obama was speaking to a Democratic audience, and he said something I'll never forget. He's pointing out how the Democratic Party, for him, was superior to the Republican Party. He says, don't vote for the Republicans. As everybody here knows, they just want to take us back to 1920. I thought that was a remarkable thing to say. Not because Obama said it. Of course, it's natural for him to say. But the point is, he didn't have to explain to his audience why 2008 was superior to 1920. Because he could assume that their assumption about life would be that, well, obviously, our morality today and our view of politics today, our view of truth today, our view of right and wrong today is obviously superior. to what it was in 1920. And there's nothing in 1920, nothing in 1920 that we would want to recover. Therefore, you should vote for us because the Republicans want to take us back. We want to go forward. So that, in a nutshell, is modernity or modernism. That's just kind of the big picture looking over everything. All right, now let's get to postmodernism. So what does post mean? What does that word post mean? After. So postmodernism means after modernism. I think I'm going to give you two key elements of the best way to understand postmodernism. Now, if the view of modernism is that things must constantly be changing to keep up to date, there is this element of the measure of linear history, as history goes on, is also the measure of moral improvement. What happens when modernism gets old? Now, think about that for a minute. And that's where the postmodernists were able to come up with an idea to sort of subvert modernism. Because this notion that everything must be new all the time was new in the 1920s. But the idea that everything must be new all the time was not new in the 1960s and 70s. You see how ironic this is? And so the postmodernists said, we're no longer going to hold this view of progress, that there is this sort of moral and ethical and historical and political progress. We're basically going to hold the view that what is called progress by modernists is essentially a pipe dream. And the only thing that is important is the individual, what my view is, or small communities of people who get together and decide for themselves what reality is or what truth is. And so they developed what we would call constructivist views of reality. That is, reality is what comes out of your own mind. You'll even hear this sometimes. People be on TV and somebody will make an assertion about right and wrong. And somebody says, well, okay, man, that's your reality. That's not my reality. But I mean, you would think historically reality is not optional. I mean, reality is what it is. But that's not true with postmodernity. Postmodernists are going to say we get to construct our own reality. Everybody following me here? You see what I'm saying? Now, if you'd like to know where a lot of the transgenderism and things like that come from, it's not just from pure raw sexual rebellion, although certainly it is that too. It's from a particular mentality that justifies that rebellion, which is I get to define my reality. And you can't define my reality. You can't say that I'm a male just because I have male, or as the case is, female sexual organs. I get to decide that. That's my reality. Now, I know that to all of us in this room, because we are Christians and shaped by a basic Christian worldview, that doesn't just sound mistaken. That sounds bizarre. But I assure you, there are very educated people, and sometimes the more educated, the more they believe this, that believe that very thing. Therefore, for them, reality must be overcome. The real enemy is reality itself. We must reconstruct our own reality. Another way of looking at this is a three-word definition by one of the most famous postmodernists, at least definers and explainers of postmodernism. I think your pastor's read the book by Lyotard, a Frenchman. He describes postmodernism. He says, if you want to reduce it, it's incredulity toward metanarratives. Don't you love all these long words? It's really actually easy to understand if you force somebody to explain it to you, which I'm going to do. You don't have to force me. I'll explain it to you. A metanarrative is a big picture of the world. We would say like a worldview. It's an explanation of how things came about, of why humans are the way they are, why the world is the way it is, and where it's probably going to end up. Well, if Christianity is a meta-narrative by that, I mean, what is the first verse in the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, right there, that's laying the foundation for what they would call a meta-narrative. It talks about how we got here. It talks about how things went bad. It talks about how God would promise to send his son to get things right again. It talks about where history is going and how it's going to end. That, my friends, is a very big meta-narrative. But as a matter of fact, Islam has a meta-narrative, and even the Enlightenment has a meta-narrative. It breaks with the Bible, and for that reason is wrong. But it's kind of like each of these often have a big picture. Certainly, Marxism is a meta-narrative. For Marxism, the big thing is society is basically about overcoming oppression. People are always oppressing one another. Groups, classes are oppressing one another. So history is basically a record of one class oppressing another class. That's false, of course, but it is a very big picture of the world. Well, the postmodernists wanted to say all of that is destructive, and anytime anybody offers a meta-narrative, it becomes dangerous because they want the world to be the way they think it should be. That's the problem with you Christians. That's the problem with you, Sandlin. That's the problem with Pastor Enoch in this church. You say you have an explanation for why things the way they are, the way the world is, and that's very dangerous because you're saying the other ones are wrong. And what right have you to say that? So that's where we get the incredulity toward meta-narratives. In other words, they're highly suspicious of any explanation of the world. And therefore, it's really kind of odd. If you've read postmodernists, and I don't recommend that you do that, they develop because there's an unseriousness, a playfulness. Because we can't deal with very big issues of life, we just kind of fool around. Now, one example of that you probably heard of, you remember a number of years ago, you maybe have heard about the French literary critic, he's now dead, Jacques Derrida, and deconstruction, the deconstruction of text. How many remember that? All right, let me tell you about it. So this is the notion, and only, of course, very educated people can say things this stupid. The notion that somebody would write a book, and let's not even talk about the Bible yet, but some other book, Mark Twain, let's say, writes a book. The notion that we should try to find out what Mark Twain meant when he wrote that book in order to understand the book is sort of allowing Twain to be an imperialist on our thinking. I mean, so what if he's the author? What right has he to tell me what I think this book means? So, well, he actually wrote the book. Doesn't matter. I have a right to determine what this book means. I mean, what right does he have? Because they would say he was influenced by all sorts of factors he didn't understand at the time. He was, for instance, they would say that he was a sexist, and he was a racist, and he was a misogynist, and he might have been a Western imperialist, and all of that influenced his writing. So we will deconstruct this and sort of make it say anything that we want it to say. Now, that's a prime example of postmodernity. Does anybody here know of, if you saw classical architecture, you'd probably know what it was, like a lot of Greco-Roman and Christian influence, medieval architecture, a lot of ornamentation, right? A lot of ornaments, like Victorian. Now, if you saw modern architecture, it's quite different. Anybody see the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright, for example? Okay. Maybe Falling Water in Pennsylvania. I mean, when you see architecture where there's a lot of glass, and has anybody here been to London or seen a picture of the Shard in London? I think it's got to be the tallest building in London, I would think. It's designed to look like a shard of glass leaning a little bit, and that's really what it looks like. Somebody took a huge glass and stuck it in the ground, and they're almost right next to it. You have St. Paul's Cathedral, one of the great classical pieces of architecture. Now, understand this isn't just two different ways of building buildings. These are two worldviews. St. Paul's, and I don't agree with Anglicanism, certainly the way that it is now, but the people who built that, Christopher Wren, had a particular worldview. And it was a Christian worldview. And there was to be order and beauty and realism and gorgeous ornamentation. In fact, some of classical architecture was influenced by what was thought to be the views of how the Hebrew temple was built. Truly remarkable, but not the modernists, remember? We are the destroyers. So everything in the past has to be set aside. And out of our own imagination, we can just create what we want to create. Now, I'll kind of close with this. All of that is important, but perhaps the most dangerous aspect of postmodernity is its absolute relativism and moral relativism. Now, what do I mean by relativism? That truth and beauty and all of these ultimate things are not something that can be understood as a shared external reality, but that particularly right and wrong are determined only by specific circumstances. So it would be wrong to say that adultery is always wrong. It would be wrong to say that what we call as murder is always wrong. That has to be determined by circumstances. Because after all, if you create reality, and ethics is an aspect of reality, you get to create your own ethics. Okay? It's interesting. That some of you know one of the great, well, probably the most prominent trial, most momentous trial of the 20th century was the Nuremberg trials, where various Nazis were tried, right, after World War II. The premise, although it wasn't explicitly Christian by any means, the premise behind the Nuremberg trials is that there is an absolute moral standard of right and wrong. Eichmann and others were tried there for killing Jews. And do you know what their defense was? And many of them marshaled a very good postmodern, what we call today postmodern defense. And they said, I was only obeying orders. And this is exactly what National Socialism had taught. It's a worldview. And it had taught the Jews are inferior people and we must cleanse our nation and cleanse Europe of these people. The way to do that, sorry, is to exterminate them. This was the unrepentant to the end, I must tell you. It was the right thing to do, and I'm not repentant for that, because that was the reality in which we were operating. And some of them still believed it. And from a postmodern standpoint, that's correct. That's correct. Thank God the people holding that trial, the United States in particular, and the Western powers, though Russia was in on it, their view is quite postmodern, Marxism, which I won't go into right now. But you see how that all of these people today who like to say, well, you have your right and wrong and I have my right and wrong, how utterly postmodern that really is. No one you realize can live that way. It's just, it's what I like to call sort of boutique postmodernism. It's like the college freshman in the dorm that likes to spout moral relativism until somebody steals his iPad. Who stole my iPad? Well, man, I mean, it's just they, you know, this wasn't wrong to them. Yeah, but he shouldn't have stole it. It was mine. Yeah, but, I mean, you're the one telling everybody that you can make up your own ethical and moral standards. So moral relativism is, of course, self-defeating. So tying things up here. So postmodernity is really a subversion of modernism. Some call it just hypermodernity. And in the words of Gilbert Chesterton, he was a famous Christian British writer, he says, he had these quaint little expressions, he says, they end up undermining their own minds. The modernists had wanted to undermine a Christian civilization and Western culture by making everything new, but their very idea that everything must be new was itself undermined by the latest thing that came along, which was postmodernism. I guess, aside from other issues, the most dangerous aspect of postmodernity is that it cuts the moral nerve. Everything becomes playful. Everything becomes your reality. No one can stand up on great moral authority and say, that is wrong. And when Jews or blacks or Hispanics or whites or Christians are persecuted, no consistent postmodernist can say, that's morally wrong and must be opposed and we will hold you accountable. And so they don't. They just kind of sit back. Or they will say this. Everything's a power play. And even though we can't prove you're morally wrong, we like our idea better, so we're just going to shut you up. Stanley Fish, one of the great postmodernists, he was at Duke. He said, if you read his stuff, it's just mind-blowingly consistent and consistent in a bad way. It's basically the people that get the guns get to decide what's right and wrong. Well, that's not the biblical way and the American way. The American way is we operate by a rule of law, and everybody's subject to a law. And even the people that, the government that carry guns are subject to law, and the president is subject to law. But that's not the postmodern way. The postmodern way is the group that thinks that it could has a good grasp of reality should get power and decide what everybody else should do. That's the danger of postmodernity, and that's the world in which we live. All right, I've been talking for a long time now and perhaps raise as many questions as I answered. Does anybody have any question or any questions or comments?
So in in this changing of thought, art reflects that. Does art lead the way, or does art follow what is going on?
Great question, Monty. I think historically it's both. I think in the late 19th century, if you study what the Impressionists were all about, it all came, or almost all of it came from Paris. So many bad ideas come out of Paris. A lot from Germany, too. But they were, these guys were just strongly opposed to this very, they were all trained, or many of them were trained by a school of art in Paris that everything, you know, you draw the lines this way, to make good art, you do it this way. They were young, and they rebelled against that. And they said, we're going to produce art for our time. That's really cool for us. But in producing that art, by the way, a lot of people flocked to Paris at the time, and not just artists, but others. It was kind of like what, you know, Greenwich Village was, the 60s. You know, the young, rebellious, hip artists, not just those who drew, but musicians. Beatniks. And what's that?
Beatniks,
yeah. Architects, all of these people that wanted to be revolutionaries. Well, it is true to say that that art did influence culture, but it also was a reflection of what was also going on at the time. Late in the 19th century, there were a lot of people that were just kind of sick of Christianity. Darwinism had produced, had set forth the idea about scientific evolution, but then that led to the notion of social evolution. And now you think about this, how we think of Darwinism, biological evolution, but this fits in very well with modernism and the idea that we're constantly evolving into something better. So the answer to that is that both, they have sort of a symbiotic effect. Art affects culture and culture affects art both ways.
Well, I don't want to give artists that much power.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
Surely we can find somebody better to lead culture than
that's right.
Artists.
Yeah, that's right. But they do, sadly. In our society, I think that probably the artists that probably have the greatest power over the greatest number of people are the what we call artists. Well, you may not want to call them artists, but in Hollywood, because of the immediacy of the picture, and just truly remarkable the impact that they have.
Musicians,
prime, yep, right up there. The musicians, prime influence in postmodernism. Now, I'm saying talking about modernism and postmodernism subverting it, I'm not saying that modernism is gone. You could actually still see both of these in our culture. Certainly the planned obsolescence and how, I mean, all of you know this, right? I mean, things are made to be broken. I mean, things are made very cheaply. Why? Because people's attitude is, I don't want to spend any money to fix something to keep it for 50 years. I want to buy a new one. Because a new one, man, that new iPhone has got an extra camera on it. And I can put 17,000 songs on that one instead of 16,599. Being facetious, but you know what I'm talking about there. But what's true in those areas is true in virtually all other areas also. We live in sort of a throwaway culture. That's modernism. Or here I'm talking in, and you guys should be talking. Any questions or comments? Don't feel like there's any question that's too... There are no dumb questions.
Reluctance to allow other viewpoints to shape what we think that led to the deconstructionist view of literary texts, and I wish Gracie was here to comment on her exposure to that in her
yes.
master's program. You know, the how could you ever get that out of this
right.
sort of a comment, but that has serious implications on our American culture as it applies to our government and the Constitution.
Great point, Eric. So with postmodernity, there is no longer any idea. Where there's no shared reality, there can be no common discourse. By that, I mean we can't just sit down and talk things out. Now, that could be done and was done at a lot of debates historically, even with atheists. And there are still honest atheists. I mean, procedurally honest, we could sit down and have a discussion. You know, why are you an atheist? Well, you know, there can't be a God because there's such evil in the world. And then I would point out to him, well, why would you use the term evil if there's no God? We could have a sort of a rational discussion. But postmodernists really don't believe in that common elements of discourse anymore, because they're always looking at one, like your or my discourse, as a power play. You're trying to shape the terms of the debate, and that's where idiotic ideas come. I'm like white logic or feminist grammar or homosexual astrophysics. Now, that sounds very strange to us, but it's not strange if you believe that everything is a construction of a particular class or of a particular sexual identity. And that's where you come, particularly in universities. And you're right, you mentioned the Constitution. This is where, although the seeds were planted a long time ago, this is where a lot of the attack on the judicial originalism comes from. I mean, there are two basic ways of interpreting the Constitution. There is originalism, which is interpret the Constitution according to what the framers intended when they wrote it. That's essentially the conservative view. Now there's the idea of the living Constitution or the evolving Constitution. You can see how that in many ways is post-modern, because we don't want to tie this text up in the past. Well, the founders are smart enough to know they weren't infallible, so they also created within the text a way to amend it. The Constitution can be amended. It's not the infallible Word of God. But, of course, judges don't want to amend the Constitution because it takes a wide group of people, states. As you know, there's a pretty laborious process to amend it. So judges who often go to places like Yale Law School, Yale, Harvard, and places like that are taught that, well, your responsibility is to basically correct these founders who were sexist. I mean, they were nice guys at the time, but I mean, some of them owned slaves, and they were like white, and they didn't understand women. They put down women all the time, and they were Christian or influenced by Christianity. So obviously, the document that they produced was a highly inferior document, so you need to correct them. That's the living Constitution way. And this, by the way, as you can tell, this goes into all sorts of fields, art and literature and music and politics and church. So think about it for a minute. So I don't know of any church in Pratt this way, but the notion that every new trend that comes along, you know, the churches are buying into the latest trend. Well, think about it. That's modernity. And then dipping over into postmodernity is the idea that, well, each of you that comes, you kind of can decide. Each of you decide your own conception of God. We're just here to facilitate your view of God, rather than, as happens in this church, the pastor stands up on the basis of the Bible and declares and applies the Word of God. That would be considered imperialistic. That is, that he's trying to impose an old view on a book that's obviously outmoded and outdated. Sharon and I, when we lived, I worked for the Chalcedon Foundation for years. There was a church nearby there, not having no association with that foundation. But I'll never forget, some dear friends of ours at the time said they visited this church, and the pastor made an obligatory visit to them. And one thing they wanted to know, they asked, "What does your church believe?" And his immediate response was, "Well, what would you like us to believe?" Oh, my. True story. That's a reflection of postmodernity, you see. Yes, ma'am.
Did the thinkers and scholars in the modern era time, were they able to look forward and see that there was going to be like a postmodern and predict that thing? And if that's the case, are there people in this time of postmodernism looking forward to what could be the next?
You see why I married her. That's a very smart question. To my knowledge, there was really nobody that was a champion of modernity that really saw that. Because for them, when you're on anything new, it seems exciting, and you're not thinking something could come after this. And anybody ever hear, a good example of this, I haven't mentioned, we talked about music earlier, but modern music. Now, that I don't mean rock and roll. I mean, like Stravinsky and Schoenberg, if you hear that dissonant, it's a very dissonant kind of music. You listen to it, it's like scratching, not all of it, but some of it, scratching nails. And if you compare it to Beethoven, which was romantic, but particularly to Bach and earlier, the Baroque era music, how totally different it is. Well, they were highly experimental. They're the modern classical. I know we say classical, it sounds. Their music, they would argue, is a modern form of classical, but they were trying to break away from all of that stuff that went before. A lot of that would have also, in a strange way, though it sounds different, did help lay the groundwork for rock and roll. Okay, not identical by any means, but lay the groundwork for it. But the real question here that's powerful is, are there people today, postmodernists, that are thinking about what could come after postmodernism? The only ones that are thinking about that are saying very frightening things, because think about it. What would come after postmodernity when there is no longer a shared reality and the understanding that everybody, as in judges, everybody literally does that which is right in his own eyes, would be a strong armed state force that would have to force a kind of conformity onto society to keep it from totally falling apart. And that's what's especially frightening. The wonderful thing about God's view of civil government is it provides liberty within the bounds of law. It provides for an individual liberty. You can do what you want within the foundation of God's moral law. I mean, you can't violate God's law. You can't expropriate somebody's property. You can't steal his wife or husband. You have to treat one another civilly according to the word of God. But within that, you can live as you want to live. Unbelievers can, and believers too, as long as they respect the moral law of God. But once you get rid of this foundation, the moral law of God, then basically everything is a jump ball. I hear that we have some basketball fans. Okay. This means everything is a jump. Every play begins as a jump ball. You say, well, that can't happen. Right. It just would lead to chaos. And that's where this, if things look chaotic in society, that's why. That's why. We have, by the way, a fairly interesting, not identical, example of that in the 20th century. How many of you know what the political, cultural situation was described as, the time period after in Germany after the end of World War I to the beginning of Hitler's rise to power? It's called the Weimar Republic. Remarkably decadent. I mean, the things that went on were, and this is even apart from the terrible inflation and the depression. The people that started it were well-meaning, but it just, things kind of fell apart. The communists were fighting to win in Germany, and the Nazis were fighting them. And then there was this poor, poor constitutional republic that nobody really wanted. And eventually, of course, the National Socialist Party took power. Now, those of you that know history know something. People say, well, like the Soviet Union, they took out their guns and they took over Russia. They started killing people. But that's not what happened in Germany. Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists were democratically elected. So the idea that, well, if people just have the choice, they'll make a pretty good choice. Well, they had a choice in Germany, and they voted for Adolf Hitler. So the fact that we're a constitutional republic is no guarantee that the majority of people won't vote in something that is very destructive. All right, more questions and comments. Every time you don't talk, I end up talking.
And we're going into colleges that we have today don't have a strong foundation. They don't stand a chance for.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure how. I'm not sure how to combat that the way things are now, except from, of course, Christian schools and homeschools. I don't think it's wrong. We don't need to be sending our children in, I would say, and certainly in most cases, there might be some exceptions, flooding public schools with Christian young people. But I don't think it's wrong for some Christian teachers to teach in public schools. Now, in some cases, that's not going to work. In other cases, it will. But many of them have gone so far. This is probably less true in Pratt than it is in California. But that there has to be an alternative in Christian schools. And
but you also don't advise just to withdraw from
culture?
From Christians to withdraw from.
No. No, that's right. I mean, particularly going to university or something like that. No, I mean, the fact is, because of God's common grace, let's just take as a prime example, there are, to my knowledge, no Christian, distinctively Christian medical schools. Now, you can get a pre-med degree, and I think at ORU and a couple of other places. Some Christian law schools, not a lot of them. So that's where Christians have dropped the ball. I mean, we need distinctively Christian medical schools and law schools and architectural schools, but Christians haven't stressed higher education. Now, think about it. We haven't stressed higher education for 100 years thinking, oh, the liberals and the secularists have taken that. And plus, you get too smart like that and you'll go off to the devil. Totally false. I mean, they've never read Augustine or Aquinas or Calvin, or some of the greatest thinkers in the Western tradition were Christians, devout Christians, Pascal and others. I mean, we could go on and on and on and on. Virtually all of the early modern scientists were Christian. Virtually all of them. We couldn't have couldn't have had modern science without Christianity. So, but Christians have gradually privatized, they have withdrawn, and now we're kind of having to pay the piper for that. So my view is that we need to train young Christians up to be leaders in these fields so that we don't have to rely on these schools. It's going to be very hard, but we can do it. We're going to win. We're going to win this battle. You and I might not be alive to see it, but we're going to win this thing.
But a lot of the schools that you're talking about started as...
Oh, absolutely. Harvard, Divinity School, Yale, all of those schools were started as Christian schools.
Right.
All of them were. And we're infiltrated by the Enlightenment and false ideas. And you say, well, how did that happen? Well, there are different reasons, different times and different schools. But the underlying reason is an unwillingness to stand without compromise on the authority of the Word of God. And a lot of these professors at the time, younger people, would go to Germany and France and get graduate education and learn apostate ideas and come back and import them at Yale and Harvard, including the divinity schools, and now they're hotbeds of apostasy, and a lot of it idiotic apostasy. That's what happens when you compromise the truth of God's word.
Is there any way to turn those schools back around?
I believe that one day, and I don't know that I'll be alive for this, but one day, you're going to have a matriculating class at Harvard, and they're all going to come in and swear allegiance to Jesus Christ. And reading some of the early inaugural statements from the early presidents, Timothy Dwight and various others at some of those schools, you students are here to learn and to give glory to God. Yes, I believe that's going to happen one day. Now, here's the reason for that. Yes, fundamentally because of the promises of the Word of God, but also because we live in a God-rigged universe. Do you know why these people that we're opposing, I mean, not individually that we hate them, but the ideas, you want to know why that their views can't succeed and go on, won't go on? Because they can't. We live in a universe that is rigged by God's standards. And therefore, they're going to eventually be beating their heads against the wall. Here's the thing. When you fight reality, you're not going to win. Now, you can do a lot of damage in the meantime. Transgenderism. Yeah, you can fight reality and create terrible, destructive messes of lives. And the same thing is true with ideas. I mean, Darwinism and postmodernism and Marxism. It won't succeed, but in failing, they can fail spectacularly. I mean, the Soviet Union was a spectacular failure. And millions and millions died. That's the problem. Not that it succeeded, but that in failing, it cost so many lives. And that's true across the board.
Eventually, the inconsistencies and the impracticalities of every non-Christian worldview becomes evident.
Yes.
And like Chesterton said, you know, undermining their own minds.
That's right.
Even, I mean, postmodernism will fall into the pit that it has dug.
That's right.
When it becomes evident to everyone that postmodernism is a worldview.
Exactly.
That's playing its own, making its own power play.
That's right. You know, see what he's saying there? And smart postmodernists will often see that and they'll say, well, yeah, but we don't care. But eventually that's not going to work. Yeah. Eventually that's not going to work.
What role do you think social media plays on all of this? Just because, I mean, everything's so now.
Yes.
And then also you can talk to, you have so many followings or whatever that, I mean,
And you have people who are called influencers.
Yes.
Yeah, and stuff. And so I don't know if that mm-hmm. plays a big role in it, because, I mean, it's, you would, you know, 20 years ago, you would never have heard of some random person, but
that's
now
right.
you know, you're following them and they say something like that.
So, good question about social media and the havoc it can wreak. But so let's let that not be the variable, and let's let the variable be the kind of people that use it. Let's think if we had a society of mostly godly people or Christian people, and those that weren't Christian were influenced by Christianity, social media wouldn't be a problem, would it?
True.
So the issue here is not the technology, and here's why I say that. Good question, but one could equally have made the argument about the great cutting-edge modern technology several hundred years ago called the printing press. And people did that. Well, you can't. Well, I mean, you could put something on a printing press and put it on horses, and it can be halfway across Europe in like 3 days. We can't allow that. You see, now to us, it's virtually instantaneous. So there is the possibility that really bad ideas can be transmitted with great rapidity. But that also means that good ideas can be transmitted with great rapidity.
What about like Mark Zuckerberg and all, you know, Facebook team filtering?
Oh, yes.
Things? I mean, because then it becomes skewed.
That's right. So the problem there is not the technology, but the people who are running and monopolizing the technology. But I agree with you, though. That's all this business is very bad. I mean, they can control. But that's true. Well, think about it. In their own way, what they're doing is really not very different from the censorship that went on in the Soviet Union with Pravda and their newspaper. Now, of course, it's different in that it's a much more pervasive technology and it's in a supposed free market economy. But still, they're kind of doing the same thing. So the problem wasn't the newspaper. The problem was the people who were controlling the newspaper.
Same with
social media. Now, can it be dangerous? You bet. Can you rely on it first thing and not engage with people like we're? Yes, but that's not really the fault of the technology. That's the fault of people. Should we take our phones sometimes, just lock them up and put them away? Sure, just put them away. So you could you live like some? I mean, I couldn't live an hour without an iPhone. I mean, I would start getting panic attacks. It would be real. Well, you know, do you realize that just a few years ago, I mean, everybody didn't have one, and everybody was just fine. So, good questions. Any others?
And I think, too, don't you, that the nature of the medium in social media has several severe limitations, one being, well, like with Twitter, 140 characters, is it?
Yes.
I don't tweet, so I
yes.
think they talked about increasing the number. But anyway,
right.
you can't deal with substantively with
that's
any
right.
subject in so short a
that's right.
time frame.
Well, not only social media, but media in general. You know, you can't keep someone's attention for more than a 30-second video.
That's right.
So it's the same whether it's social media or it's media.
I'm still at about 5 minutes.
You know what's interesting about that too, though, this has always been a criticism of these kinds of technologies. Back in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, this was an argument against newspapers. You can't write an article long enough to deal substantively with an issue. And today people don't even print a newspaper. I mean, newspapers are dying, you know, and most of them need to die, but I'm not going to. I mean, some of you are here old enough. Remember when you get the morning paper and then you get the evening paper? I remember Cincinnati did. They had two. You get one in the morning and get one in the evening. Well, now you can't even get one anywhere just about except for the godless New York Times and others that are heavily subsidized.
And now on, like on some articles that are posted on Facebook, it'll say two-minute read.
Yes, two-minute read. Right.
Five-minute read. So it's like that alerts you, or I guess supposed to alert you as to whether or not you want to invest the time to investigate further.
That's
well,
right.
I can read in 5 minutes. Most people can read in two.
Well, the whole premise of journalism has changed so much.
Right? Yes, it has. Yeah, now that's a separate issue. I mean, what was once called objective journalism and called hard reporting is almost a thing of the past. Almost everything you see on TV as news today is what was once called opinion journalism. And that's true as much as many conservatives as it is liberals. It's opinion journalism. That's why when you do see very good, what we call hard shoe leather reporting, it's a beautiful thing to behold. I remember one was in 2012. This is rather rare. It was in The Atlantic, which is not a great publication, but at least there was a wonderful, very long background article on Mitt Romney and his history. There have been four or five people had investigated his past and everything, and the good and the bad, and it was what you call shoe leather reporting. They weren't telling you he's a bad man, he's a good man, but he's a man. And here's what he's done. It was a most beautiful piece of reporting. You could finish that and say, okay, now I can make an objective judgment about this man politically just by reading that. But as you know, that's not the kind of thing that you'll see on CNN, or for that matter, mostly on Fox News. That's what's changed.
And it stands out because it is so rare.
It is so rare, exactly. Yes. That's right. Yeah. And part of that is just a little bit of what I think it was what Eric said. No, it was what Monty said. A lot of that is they will the people leading this, they will say, well, that's just what people want. And to a degree, that's right. So this is a cultural problem. By the way, this is one reason we need to be careful not to criticize too much the elites. Now, most of the elitism in this country is just leftist and bad. But don't fall into the populist notion of, well, if the people just had their way, when the people just had their way, we'd get things back. Well, the problem with that is people can be pretty depraved. I mean, Barack Obama, now, would most of you agree with me that Barack Obama is a leftist? Okay. He actually did win fair and square. I have friends who say, there's no way. It had to have been a rigged election, which is what people that don't like Donald Trump say about him. Actually, would you like to know why Barack Obama won fair and square? Because you have a lot of people in this country that actually agree with his worldview. Another thing I'll say about Barack Obama and the conspiracy theories. I talk to people who have said Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi get up in the morning. They want nothing more than to destroy this country. Wrong. It's more dangerous than that. They want to save this country. That's the problem. The problem is they don't share a conspiracy. They share a worldview. They want to do very good in this country. And in doing good, they will destroy the country. But Barack Obama didn't get up every morning, what can I do to destroy America today? No. His view, expressed by his wife, is now, she said, I finally feel good about being a patriotic American now that my husband is elected. Well, we think that's bizarre, and it is. But she wasn't lying about that. Why? Because she had a different worldview. The wrong kind of worldview. Everybody understand that point? I mean, Barack Obama was duly elected. Donald Trump was duly elected. And even if there was a little hanky-panky here and there, it wasn't like over 700 votes. Now, 2000 election, that's a little different. A few hundred votes in Florida. But that was, most of the time, the elections are not that way. Yes, ma'am.
So you were saying that the people in Paris, their art form was always against what their teachers said. But how do we know that that isn't just how we perceive it and not how they meant it? Because what if they just thought that it looked nice?
Yeah, good question. I'm sure they did think that. So it wasn't just an act of rebellion. I mean, if you look at what Renoir and some of it is just really beautiful, very impressionistic. Another, a more bizarre example, but a more popular modernist is Picasso. Now, some of his cubism is just utterly bizarre, and some of it's perverse. I mean, had a terribly low view of women. But there's no doubt that they thought they were doing good, but their worldview wasn't shaped by Christianity. It was shaped by an attempt to rebel against the standards that Christianity had laid out. In saying standards, I'm not saying that all of the previous classical art was painted by Christians. I'm simply saying that a Christian worldview, I mean, if you look at the paintings from most of the paintings from the 17th and 18th century, even the unbelievers, there's a realism about it and a beauty about it. And particularly this point, this is vital, a recognition of the reality of the external world. That my job is to essentially to conform the painting to what the world really is like. And yes, I may adjust it here and there, but basically the world out here is the real world, and I am depicting what that is or what it should be like or whatever. But that's not the view of many modernists, and certainly not postmodernists. So their view is what the inward turn, which is basically, how would they say it? They would, particularly postmodernists, here's a way to look at this. I don't only paint a painting, I put myself into the painting. That is, I myself am the work of art. So it's my imagination, it's what I can imagine that is important. And therefore, you have if you went into any of the MoMAs, Museum of Modern Art, most major cities have them, you don't want to go there. I mean, for the most part, it's pretty bizarre. And even when it's not crude, it's the bizarreness of it will show there's a worldview operating here that's very different from a Christian worldview. Who's the Russian, is the early Soviet painter. By the way, the early Soviet Union was much in favor of modernism, if you think about it. He was the one that his famous painting was White Square on a White Background. because it was innovative and different. It's interesting that Lenin and Stalin at the beginning favored modernism. Because why? Because it was revolutionary. It was breaking with the past. But after about 10 or 15 years, these guys also wanted to break with the recent past, which was the Soviet Union. And they said, no, we're not going to allow that. We're going to throw you in jail and kill you. Or stop doing it, or we're going to kill you. So the issue is not that they were insincere in their rebellion necessarily, but they certainly had a different way of thinking and worldview. What I'm saying here is, and I'll close with this maybe, unless Doug wants me to go until midnight, which I shouldn't do.
Only if you promise to raise the dead.
Like okay. Different worldviews create different ways of thinking and acting. That's one of the main things you need to understand. So when you see something that looks dramatically different, a work of art, music, a church, a book, there's a reason for that. Anybody here know about James Joyce's book Ulysses or some of the modern literature? Virginia Woolf, a lot of Ulysses by James Joyce, prominent modernist, is, if you read it, it's stream of consciousness. Now, most people earlier than that would write in a logical order. Well, he writes as though people think most of the time. We're walking along the street, and we have a thought, and we say, oh, that's a really bright yellow car. I've never seen that color of yellow. That's really disgusting. And then we don't go back to the original thought. We're thinking, my, that's a tall building. Well, you know what? That reminds me of the electric bill I need to pay. Well, that stream of consciousness. Well, he wrote the book Ulysses like that, and it's very hard to read. But his goal was to break with the past, you see.
It's kind of chaotic. It's intentionally to try to illustrate their belief that there is no coherence.
Yes,
no logical conception of reality that we can have. And as you've mentioned, the thing that was for so long hard for me to understand was that the postmodernists really were trying to say there is no reality.
Yes.
A book that Andrew encouraged me to purchase last year when he was here was a book by Walter Truett Anderson, Reality is Not What It Used to Be. You know, and that's the fundamental point. We have been long under the assumption that there is a shared reality that if we all take effort to investigate, we can come to the same conclusions and perceive it the same way and have an accurate understanding of it. But now the understanding is that there is no shared reality out there. And if there is a reality, we'd all have a different impression of it anyway, so we wouldn't even agree. And anytime, Andrew said earlier, anytime we try to tell our neighbor this is what reality is really like, I'm trying to exercise power over him. And so it's all disingenuous. It's all a power play. And you can just see how so destructive that is.
And it has a big impact even on something when you say, well, thank God we don't have to worry about that. We're just a gospel-preaching church. Do you understand how the gospel is impaired? You share the gospel. You need to trust in Jesus Christ. Well, hey, man, that's your reality. You know, I've got my own reality. Is Jesus working for you, man? Is he working for you? Then fine. But he's not working in my reality. You say, well, you're a sinner. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, racism is a sin, and homophobia might be bad, and I don't like it. But, man, if that's your reality, you see how you can't say, well, you shouldn't be thinking about these things like postmodernism. Just preach the simple gospel. In the end, what we call the simple gospel is not quite so simple when it has to meet things like this.
Where I work, there's a lot of people that are lost, clearly lost, just by their lifestyle, their language, their actions, and everything. I'm sure a lot of people are in that same situation. But what concerns me is you can go to churches, and inside those churches, it may not be these same people, but you have these cultural Christians that think we're okay, you know?
Yes.
And the gospel message is not being preached.
Right.
But people go away with this satisfied,
yes,
I'm good for a week. And I think there's a real, real danger in people assuming they're good enough.
Yes.
And it really, really grieves me because there's so many churches that are even growing.
Yes.
And people are lost.
That's right.
They think they're good enough.
That's right. No, that's true, and that's a tragedy. I always get a little chuckle when I hear people say, well, I like to go, here's another sort of buzzword, I like to go to that church because it's a safe space. Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, it should be physically safe, but many of them mean I can feel safe in my sin. But the church is not designed as a place where you can feel safe in your sin. You say, well, I want a welcoming church. Well, of course, your church is a welcoming church. Anybody that wants to come and behave themselves is permitted to come to the church. But they need to hear a message that will truly confront the way that they're really like. We're not truly loving people if we don't tell them their true condition. Could you imagine a doctor, you're having a severe pain, you go in and the doctor looks at it and he detects that it is a very fast-acting cancer. And he says, well, I don't want to offend you, this person. This person's a dear friend. So just, I'm going to just give you a prescription. You just go, and I'm going to give you a prescription for a painkiller. You would say that that doctor was guilty of malpractice, would you not? But we have ministers that are guilty of malpractice because they don't speak the truth. You have a man here that is gracious but will speak the truth. That's what the minister's calling is. He takes an oath that he will speak the truth of the Word of God. And you're exactly right. By the way, one reason those churches grow, I'll never forget what I think I mentioned today, a friend of mine, a theologian now deceased 20 years ago dead, R.J. Rushdoony said, he said one time to me, he had these little short aphorisms that are very powerful. He says, Andrew, I can promise you, if you don't preach against sin, you'll build a big church. There's a lot of truth in that. You don't preach against sin, you'll build a big church.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You bet.
Appreciate it.
You guys have been great.
Yeah.